Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I am Brian Fishman. I'm a counterterrorism research fellow at New America, a fellow with the Combating Terrorism Center at West Point, an affiliate with Stanford's Center for International Security and Cooperation, and an affiliate with UC Berkeley's Center for Right-Wing Studies, and I will be your moderator today. It is my pleasure to introduce today's special guest, Peter Bergen, CNN national security analyst and author of the new book, United States of Jihad, Investigating America's Homegrown Terrorists. Peter is a print, television, and web journalist, a documentary producer, and the author of 5 books, which have been translated into 20 languages. A documentary based on his book, Manhunt, The 10-Year Search for Bin Laden won an Emmy, and his new book is the basis for the HBO film Homegrown, The Counterterror Dilemma, which premiered in February. In 1997, as a producer for CNN, Peter produced Osama bin Laden's first television interview. In addition to his work with CNN, Peter is vice president and director of the Fellows Program and the International Security Program at New America, where years ago he hired me. He is professor and co-director of the Center on the Future of War at Arizona State University and a fellow at Fordham University's Center on National Security. He's also a member of the Homeland Security Project, a successor to the 9/11 Commission. Peter has testified before multiple congressional committees about Afghanistan, Pakistan, Al-Qaeda, drones, and other terrorism-related issues. He was born in Minneapolis, raised in London, and holds a degree in modern history from Oxford University. Please welcome me. Please welcome Peter Bergen. Thank you. Okay. Peter, thank you very much for joining us, and welcome to the West Coast.
Yeah, well, thank you for the invitation to the Commonwealth Club and everybody who came tonight. And it's a great pleasure to be on the same stage as Brian, who we've known each other professionally for a decade. Brian was working at West Point, and West Point was given very crucial documents about Al-Qaeda in Iraq when Brian led the team that published a kind of analysis of those documents, and which is very relevant to today's conversation because Al-Qaeda in Iraq, of course, is the parent organization of ISIS. This problem has been around for a long time.
Absolutely. So, Peter, I come sort of as a terrorism analyst and sort of the first generation of post-9/11 analysts. There was a very small population of folks that were really doing this before 9/11, and you were one of those people. You've been studying terrorism since Oklahoma City. And so my first question for you is that it seems to me that fear, the general perception of fear around terrorism today, is as bad as it has been since in the immediate wake of 9/11. And I'm wondering, first of all, do you agree? Is that fear justified? Does the threat justify that kind of angst? And if it doesn't, why do we feel it? Why is it now?
Polling, you're exactly right. Polling data shows that Americans are more frightened about terrorism than at any point since October 2001, which is kind of an astonishing kind of finding. Is it justified? Of course not. The likelihood of anybody in this room being killed by a terrorist is infinitesimally small, and yet 80% of Americans are very worried or somewhat worried that there will be some major terrorist attack, sometime in the not-too-distant future. And these things go in waves. San Bernardino colors a lot of this, and, as that recedes in time, people will be less frightened, but then another event will happen of some kind. We walk around with brains that we had 20,000 years ago, which were very useful for survival in the jungle and the desert. The principal thing that was useful was fear. So fear is a very dominant part of our kind of the way we see the world. So certainly as a rational matter, it doesn't make sense. But it's understandable because we're not completely rational human beings. And also there's a huge disconnect between lay perceptions of risk, and this is, there's a lot of academic literature on this. But something that can strike at any time, anywhere, that you don't have control over is more frightening than the fact that if you get into your car tonight, the statistical likelihood of having a crash is, much higher than being killed by a terrorist.
You've written a book called The United States of Jihad.
Yeah.
And yet some of the numbers in your book suggest that terrorism from other sources, non-jihadi terrorism, is a comparable kind of threat.
Yeah.
Talk through, explain to us why there is this difference in perception, because, and I really want to sort of get at this gap between the reality of the threat and how we perceive the threat. That's a big issue as we go through the election process. And how do we close that gap over time? Your experience at CNN, obviously, you are one of our communicators. You are one of our thought leaders on these issues. How do we close that gap?
I think it's going to be very hard to close, unfortunately. And clearly, do the thought experiment where in 2014, a neo-Nazi went into a Jewish community center and killed three people, and he shouted "Hell Hitler" afterwards. If he shouted "Allah Akbar" afterwards, what was a reasonably big news story would have been a seismic news story. And so we're all prisoners of the history that we've just recently lived, and 9/11 was one of the hinge events of American history. And so we filter everything through that lens when it comes to jihadist terrorism. But the fact is, we've managed and contained the problem pretty well. But as a political matter, it's very hard to say that, because the political costs of even being slightly wrong. If Hillary Clinton said, or if anybody running for office said, what is true, that we've managed and contained this problem pretty well, and then an attack happened of even relatively small size, the political costs would be enormous. Just look at the costs of the Benghazi attack, where four Americans were killed in an undefended compound in a country in the middle of a civil war. So politically, it's hard to say these things, but just to put some meat on that observation, on 9/11, there were 16 people on the fly list. Now there are 47,000. There are about 1.5 million people on a much larger list of people who might go into secondary screening. On 9/11, the FBI and CIA didn't talk to each other. There was no National Counterterrorism Center. There were relatively few joint terrorism task forces. There was no DHS, which is the Department of Homeland Security. It's the second largest U.S. government institution outside the Pentagon. There's no TSA. You might find the TSA irritating when you get on a plane, but the fact is, that's a pretty big barrier to entry for a terrorist planning to hijack an American plane or smuggle a weapon or bomb on a plane in the United States. And then there's public knowledge. On 9/11, there was very little understanding this was an issue. And if you add up everything I've just said and you add the huge force multiplier of public knowledge, it was the passengers on flight Northwest, on Northwest Flight 253 flying over Detroit, who noticed that somebody was, smoke was pouring out of his crotch, and this is not normal behavior on a plane, and the passengers and crew disabled him. So if you add all the things the government has done defensively, and then you add the public knowledge of the issue, and then you add all the things we've done offensively, basically we killed Al-Qaeda Central. We're doing a pretty good job of killing, it's going to take a while with ISIS, but we're imposing huge costs. So where we are, anybody like Brian or myself who looks at these issues, as a day-to-day matter, part of our professional work, I think understands that this is a problem we have managed and contained, but it's just very hard to say that politically.
Mm-hmm. You talk a lot in the book about how the perpetrators of terrorist attacks are in many ways ordinary Americans, and I think something that struck me reading the book, and certainly as part of my experience, is that the counterterrorism folks, the law enforcement officials, the intelligence officials, they're ordinary Americans as well, faced with extreme pressure, right? Mm. Some of the decisions that they've made, and in particular this notion of switching from a prosecutorial mindset to a prevention mindset, has in the minds of many led to oversteps that have impinged on the civil liberties of a variety of Americans, but especially American Muslims. How do you think in 15 years almost after 9/11, can we get back to a balance where to the place we were before 9/11?
I think the short answer is no. The pendulum has swung back very slightly. So the NSA phone metadata, the government is no longer taking 5 years of your phone metadata, every American putting it, and keeping it. Now that the phone companies are keeping it for a shorter period, they need to get a warrant. That is a change. But it only came about because of Edward Snowden. Another change, the NYPD kind of got rid of its demographics unit, which was sort of monitoring places that Muslims go in New York in the years after 9/11. But, it's very hard to dismantle these things. It goes back to this question of managing and containing and the political costs of saying anything like that. No one's discussing reducing the counterterrorism budget because politically it would be suicide if something if something happened after you'd done that, even though we spend a ton of money on it and there's certainly fat in the system.
No, that's yeah. depressing. So Peter, what is the question from the audience here? Saying you in the book quote Henry Kissinger, saying the reason why academic quarrels are so nasty is that the stakes are so small.
Attributed to Henry Kissinger.
Attributed to him. It's a great line. This also seems true with media coverage of the presidential elections and the national security issues that they debate.
Yeah.
If you were asking questions at the next
debate. Oh, I'll tell you
debate,
the question I would
what,
ask.
What are the national security questions that you would ask?
Here's a very good one. Will you withdraw from Afghanistan on January 20th, 2017? Now, we know what that looked like in Iraq. ISIS is already taking root, not in a big way, in southern Afghanistan and in Pakistan. Afghans are begging us to stay. They see us as a guarantor of their national stability. They don't care if it's 5,500 troops or 9,800. They're not military experts. They just want a commitment from us to stay. It doesn't have to be combat troops. It no longer is combat troops. So I would ask that question because I think that is a really interesting question. I think I know what Hillary Clinton would say. I think I would know what some Republicans would say. Mm-hmm. Do the Democrats want to be the party that withdraws from Afghanistan and then the place goes to hell in a handbasket and Al Qaeda reestablishes itself and ISIS and just do the math? And then if you're a Republican, also theoretically you don't want to see the same thing that happened in Iraq. So. That's the first question I would ask, because I think that would actually elicit some interesting answers, potentially.
Mm-hmm. And you do think that Hillary Clinton would continue to invest, and you do think that at least some of the Republican candidates, I think?
I mean, Hillary's visited Afghanistan fairly often. She was Secretary of State for a long period when that – I mean, if you go back to 2009, as you well remember, right. What was the principal foreign policy issue? It was, should we surge into Afghanistan – bear in mind that Obama tripled the number of troops there. That was a cabinet-level decision that Hillary was very much involved in. Mm-hmm. If you think about the issue of women's rights in Afghanistan, which are far from great today, I mean, they'd certainly be much worse if we left. And that was a big issue, by the way, for liberals in the pre-9/11 period, right? Mm-hmm. The Taliban were absolutely terrible, in particular the way they treated women. And I don't think there's any evidence that they've particularly changed.
Most of the attention, I think, in the press and the popular discourse today around terrorism focuses on ISIS. And Al-Qaeda, surprisingly, is sort of forgotten in much of this conversation. Al-Qaeda was deeply damaged, but we read reports now about large training complexes in Afghanistan. We know that Al-Qaeda is a very strong affiliate in Syria. Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula and Yemen is still there. There are other affiliates in North Africa, et cetera. Right now, when you think about the differences between ISIS and Al-Qaeda, how should we be thinking about strategically approaching those two organizations? Are there real fundamental differences, whether it's alliance policy, whether it's, CVE?
I think it's the difference between the Leninists and the Stalinists. I mean, it's kind of a sort of a very small dispute over tactics. Freud has a wonderful phrase, the narcissism of minor differences, which I think explains almost all human activity. And certainly, because at the end of the day, I mean, what were the Houthis and the Tutsis? I mean, no one in this room could really distinguish, right? I mean, they were very similar, yet they killed themselves at a huge rate. So that's all by way of saying that the dispute between Al-Qaeda and ISIS, there was no dispute 2 years ago. I mean, they split up 2 years ago. They could get back together. If Ayman al-Zawahiri, the leader of Al-Qaeda, was killed, there could be an accommodation. Right now, they just want to. Each one wants to be top dog in the global jihadi movement. But they could get back together. And I think Brian's made a very good point, which is Nusra, which is the Al Qaeda affiliate in Syria, is actually behaving in a much smarter way. They're building alliances and they're not sort of beheading people. And they have a lot of territory. And that this approach may be much smarter. We have the new, by the way, the new Bin Laden documents that just came out a few days ago. Underline the fact that Bin Laden was, very careful about Muslim civilian casualties in a way that ISIS is not. But it's a disagreement over tactics, not a disagreement over what the final utopia is going to look like. Mm-hmm. And the final utopia is going to be Taliban-style rule from Indonesia to Morocco. That's the dream.
Peter, it seems to me that one of the pieces that was broken with the Syrian civil war is. And maybe I'm overstating the consensus that seem to exist, at least after al-Qaeda's attacks in Saudi Arabia in 2003, 2004, that there was this general consensus among our Arab allies in the Middle East that jihadis were really dangerous, that there had been this sponsorship of these kinds of organizations in the 1980s into the 1990s, after 9/11 and in some of the post 9/11 al-Qaeda attacks against Arab governments, that everybody needed to rally to confront this particular threat. In Syria, that fell apart almost immediately because of larger sectarian and regional sort of geopolitical issues.
Yeah.
Is that broken for good?
I mean, I think that's a very smart observation because, I mean, in the previous jihads, it was directed against Serbs in Bosnia or the Russians in Afghanistan and there. But here, this jihad is really against the Shia. And this has produced a very different flavor. And so these Arab regimes, as you said, like they understood that funding jihadi groups wasn't that smart because they could come back and attack them, as happened in Saudi Arabia in 2004, 2005. And the Saudis really put the hammer down on these groups. But, you know, this anti-Shiism is such a sort of strong motivating force. ISIS is a symptom of the problem, not the cause. The cause is a regional civil war between the Sunni and the Shia in Syria and Iraq and Yemen, and ISIS is really kind of the sort of efflorescence of the situation. It's not causing the situation. Mm-hmm. So I think this has gone a long way to go because the people involved. I mean, it's central to the people who are funding these, whether it's the Saudis or the Qataris or the Kuwaitis. I mean, it's central to their ideology is a dislike/hatred for the Shia, who they regard as heretics. And Alawites, by the way, it's a heretical form of Shiism, which is what Assad, it's not even clear what Alawites believe. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's kind of a closely held secret, but it's some sort of syncretic Shiism that even Shias find, you know, kind of heretical.
I'm going to synthesize a couple of these questions from the audience. When we think about the situation in Syria today, we think about instability in the Middle East generally. We think about this renewed Cold War, if we can call it that, with Russia, maybe a little strong. But what do you think is our biggest threat going forward? And the reason why I ask that is because it strikes me that that our greatest challenge in resolving this terrible situation in Syria is that, you know, everybody says they're opposed to ISIS, but everybody involved also has something else that they prioritize more.
Right.
Right? And so while we have this grand alliance against ISIS, that alliance is extraordinarily weak. How should we prioritize our interests in Syria? And then how do you actually build a coalition around it?
I hate to quote Winston Churchill, but he has so many great lines. He says the only thing worse than a coalition is not having a coalition. So, you know, typically, you know, they're always weak, right? I mean, they always have kind of, but clearly there are people with very different priorities and, but we do have a coalition of 60 countries, and they are doing various kinds of things. So how should we prioritize? I mean, you know, at the end of the day, I think George Kennan defined national security as the ability to continue to live our lives uninterrupted by some foreign outside force. And I think that we have reached a point where at least the al-Qaeda, ISIS, I mean, the last time there was an attempted attack in the United States by a foreign terrorist organization was on May 1st, 2010 in Times Square. Mm-hmm. Faisal Shahzad, who had the wonderful previous job of working as a financial analyst for the Elizabeth Arden Cosmetics Company, not generally seen as a hotbed of jihadism, he deployed a car. And so he was the last person who from outside. So that we have a problem. The reason I wrote the book is the problem is on the inside. It's ordinary Americans. And Brian mentioned, you know, these are every lethal attack in the United States since 9/11 has been carried out by an American citizen, Major Nadal Hassan in Fort Hood, born in Arlington, Virginia. The Sarnia brothers, one was an American citizen, the other one was a legal permanent resident. In San Bernardino, the husband was born in Chicago. His wife is a legal permanent resident. Carlos Bledsoe attacked an American soldier, killed him. In Little Rock, Arkansas, comes from an African-American middle-class family in Memphis, Tennessee. So that's the problem. Now, the good news about that is that these people tend to have, that they're not trained by a foreign terrorist organization. So, you know, if you look at what happened in Paris in November, 8 guys, French citizens almost entirely, 1 Belgian, all trained by Syria by ISIS, directed, financed, trained in paramilitary tactics. They killed 130 people. Mm-hmm. You know, that we're just not going to see here. It's highly unlikely. Because we're not getting people, we're protected by geography. You can drive from Paris to Damascus. You can't drive from Damascus to San Francisco. And we're also protected by the volume of people who've gone. It's very much, the French, the most recent director of national intelligence estimate is 6,900 Westerners have gone to fight with ISIS or like-minded groups in Syria. The number of Americans in that is a handful, really. And it's usually a one-way ticket, by the way. You know, it's very dangerous. We did a report at New America, a think tank where I work. We looked at 475 Western foreign fighters. 50% of the males are dead, and 6% of the females are dead, because even though they're not allowed to go anywhere near the front line, it's so dangerous there. So, when it gets to the question of what should we prioritize, I mean, I think that we've done, we've done a pretty good job of there's been overkill in some of the things that we've taken on, whether it's the NSA or some of the FBI cases, which I think rise to not a legal level of entrapment, but certainly they feel when a schizophrenic bipolar kid in his mid-20s is sort of led with no friends, is led to believe, as a guy called Matthew Lanza was, that he was going to
in San Jose, he
was going to blow up a bank. But so, Yogi Berra famously said, it's hard to make predictions, especially about the future. And and I think that's a very profound observation. Like many things that Yogi Berra said. So what should we be prioritizing that we don't know? And I think, one area that Brian and I have both worked on in the past is the problem is not a terrorist group coming up with a biological weapon. The real problem would be a biologist who is really pretty good, who adopts jihadi ideas, or not jihadi ideas, neo-Nazi ideas. Pick your ideology, because there's sort of a Moore's law in biology now, as far as I understand it, where things that could not have been done by just a graduate student 20 years ago are within reach. I mean, so the things that can be concerned about bioterrorism carried out by if you think about the anthrax attacks. Bruce Ivins, who did that, it was one of the best microbiologists in the United States. Now, he had a highly idiosyncratic motives, but so that's something, a reasonable concern. The other concern, I think, proliferation of armed drones to terrorist groups, I think, is also, Hezbollah's already used an armed drone against an Al-Qaeda target in Syria. Now, they probably didn't make the drone themselves, but these are some things we should be thinking about seriously in terms of threats that are plausible rather than just sort of, the sky is falling.
Are there other technological innovations that you think are going to facilitate?
Yes. Yeah. I think there's a really interesting case in Toulouse where he killed seven people, and he filmed it all on a GoPro. And I think what is going to – the next iteration is have a GoPro and have a live feed that you will so that it will be – and it will cause huge problems for conventional news organizations about – I mean, they wouldn't take it, but somebody's going to, there's going to be some bottom feeder who puts it out there. And so you will have the situation where the Paris attack is actually being filmed live by the perpetrators in high def video. I mean, I think it's highly plausible. And it's already happened in Toulouse. This guy filmed everything he did. He made a tape as he was sort of basically surrounded by police, and he sent it to Al Jazeera, who didn't air it. Right. Yeah. But I think that if there was this material out there, there would be people who would be putting it out. It doesn't have to be even, ISIS has a pretty effective way of getting these things out there. So I think that's the next iteration. We all, the Westgate Mall attack in Kenya, mm-hmm. which was by Al-Shabaab, the Somali terrorist group. There was somebody live tweeting the attack who had much more reliable information than the Kenyan government about what was going on. Now, maybe that's a very low bar, but that I think was a wave of the future, right? So if they're live tweeting the attack with real the next stage is live video.
Yeah, no, I mean, we have companies based here in the Bay Area that are doing this now. Periscope, which was bought by Twitter. Facebook is working on a live video feed. So these things are becoming easier. And that raises a question that I'm sure you anticipated, that there have been several questions from the audience about, which is the Apple FBI case.
Yeah.
So this is a larger question of encryption technology. So speak specifically to the Apple FBI case. And, did Apple draw a line in the right place with this particular instance? And then more broadly, encryption technology is just getting easier to use. Yeah. It is almost a commodity at this point. And, you know, the cell phones we use all of the time, you don't have to use Mujahideen Secrets, which was an open source encryption technology that jihadis had repackaged for their purposes in 2006, 2007. Now it's on our iPhone. It's on our Android. You know, what do you think about this San Bernardino case and the Apple's objections to?
Well, what makes it a great story is both sides are right. The question is, who's more right? I mean, that will be settled not by us tonight. That will be settled by the Supreme Court. I come down slightly on the Apple side of the fence because I think market share, precedents, or the issues that they've raised are, I think, pretty legitimate. I mean, Apple is the most valuable company in the world. The second most valuable company is Google, and it's not surprising that they've joined forces. And at the end of the day, that's a very important part of the American economy. And I'm not an expert on tech, but I mean, clearly, if there's a back door, it's not encrypted. I mean, that's the whole point about encryption, is that there is no back door. Mm-hmm. So, you know, only the government case is that, you know, they have a duty to exhaust every avenue in this investigation. And he stopped backing up his iPhone on October 18th. I think the attack was on December 3rd. And there's a gap, and that something interesting is on that phone. You know, but I think I tend to come down on the Apple side of the equation.
So there's a couple questions here.
By the way, I'm not convinced that just one other point on that. The FBI did an extensive search of the house. They have a fulsome confession from the main accomplice who sold them the rifles and knew that they were plotting some kind of attack. They have all these Verizon phone records. They have, they have the stuff on the cloud before he stopped backing it up. I mean, they have. I'm skeptical of the idea there's going to be some, you know, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi sort of lengthy discussions right. inside the phone with this guy. I don't think so. But I mean, you know, that's speculation on my part.
There are a couple of questions here getting at the motivations of these Americans that radicalize. What is your take on this? And specifically, these are questions getting at, do we think about this as an ideological movement that is, to what extent, and how do we even just the language that we use, right? Mm. I mean, you've had the conversation with folks saying, why do you call this jihad? Right? Jihad for the vast majority of the world's Muslims is a spiritual struggle to be a better person and to serve God better. But we're talking about this, and implicitly this term takes on a sort of a derogatory nature, right?
Yeah.
Even if that's not what either of us intend.
Yeah.
How do we balance that? How do we balance that when we talk about it? How do we think about what is the motivation of these people that are acting on behalf of ISIS or al-Qaeda?
You know, the philosopher Immanuel Kant had a wonderful observation, which is, from the crooked timber of humanity, not a straight thing is made. And I think that's a very useful way to think about the world if you're a journalist or a historian. We're all very individual. And if everybody in this room has their own story about how they got to where they are, but if somebody actually reported out in detail about how you got there, they'll probably find some pretty interesting things that you hadn't thought about. Happenstance, just the historical time frame in which you live. I mean, each one of us is so particular and individual. And that gets to this question of, what is the role of ideology? Because my wife is from Louisiana, and I'm going to use a Louisiana metaphor. In a gumbo, you can make it about 50 million different ways. Depends what, you know, how much sausage, what kind of sausage, what kind of vegetables, how long is the roux cooked, etc. And so usually there are about five factors in all of these cases. Islamist ideology, which has something to do with Islam, just like the Palestinian the Jewish settler movement in Palestine has something to do with Jewish beliefs about Judea, and the Crusades had something to do with Christianity. So this is not a criticism of religion or of Islam, it's just a fact that this has something to do with Islam. Objections to American foreign policy, a desire to belong to something larger than yourself. Often this takes the form of, you know, joining the Peace Corps or the Marines rather than joining something like al-Qaeda or ISIS, but this is part of it. Sometimes it's fun. Some of the people I profile, you know, this is a horrible metaphor, we're having a blast. And they So some mixture of ideology, personal disappointment sometimes. So there's a there's a report that I write about in the book, the NYPD, New York Police Department, looked at a lot of cases and they found a cognitive opening, death of a parent, loss of a job, feeling of being under attack because of your Muslim kind of background, and that takes you to fundamentalist Islam and then eventually to jihadism. But I can tell you, having looked at a lot of these cases in detail, that the more you get into it, because this is really the big why question, because who is relatively easy. I mean, myself and my research team did a database, and we can make some general observations about who these people are. But when you get into the individual cases, here's an example. Major Nidal Hassan killed 13 people at Fort Hood. On the face of it, he's an Islamist, militant, very observant Muslim. He did it for Islam. But when you look into his personal life, he probably never had a physical relationship with anybody. He was about to turn 40. He was unmarried and unmarriageable. When he interviewed women who might marry him, what he asked one of them what would happen if he hit her. And that didn't go anywhere, because obviously he was like, you know, obviously that's okay, right? So there weren't too many American Muslim women just dying to marry him. He was dreading going to Afghanistan, very mediocre psychiatrist, had no friends to speak of. When I talked to his close family members, they say he sort of went postal and dressed it up in the garb of Islam, which is all by way of saying, yes, ideology has something to do with this. But, you know, lots of people object to American foreign policy. Lots of people are Islamist fundamentalists. Lots of people have personal disappointments. So lots of people are seeking for something bigger than themselves. But very few people go and kill an 8-year-old boy attending the Boston Marathon, or a 23-year-old Chinese graduate student attending the Boston Marathon, or a 29-year-old female restaurant manager attending the Boston Marathon. I mean, for what? I mean, it achieved absolutely nothing. And this gets actually to the nature of evil. This may be a kind of overly heavy topic. But
this is kind of a heavy topic to begin with.
Right. But I think evil, you can, without making comparisons to the Holocaust itself, you can explain Hitler, the environment that he grew up in Vienna in the 1920s. You can explain the ideas he had. But at the end of the day, you can't. The why becomes very hard to answer. And I think when you look at these attacks, these terrorist attacks, you can kind of explain what went into it. But you get to a point where the why is inexplicable. And maybe if you're a novelist or a filmmaker, not a nonfiction writer, maybe you could get more deeply into it and actually unpack it. But of course, that would be based on something that isn't tethered to the facts necessarily. So I think the why is the really big question. And why is it that a decade and a half after 9/11, Americans, you know, 60 cases last year, the most since 9/11 of people signing up for ISIS. Most of them are, you know, they might have joined the Weather Underground in the 70s or the Black Panthers. You know, this is one of the last revolutionary ideologies left standing. You know, we've seen this before with different kinds of ideologies. But the why is, once you dig into the cases, it gets harder and harder. Yes, there is ideology, but that is far from sufficient. And even when you try and unpack everything, you still get to a point where the why is very hard to answer.
For our radio audience, you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is CNN National Security Analyst Peter Bergen. We are discussing how to prevent terrorism on U.S. soil. I'm Brian Fishman, Counterterrorism Research Fellow at the New America Foundation, and your moderator. Peter, I'm going to read for you briefly a quote. I always like to sort of bring in the jihadis themselves into these conversations and ask you to reflect, especially in light of really the rancorous rhetoric within our presidential debate. This is a quote from Anwar al-Awlaki, who is a prime recruiter, American citizen who joined al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. Really, for years, the leading English language propagandist within the jihadi movement. And he said in 2010, "Muslims of the West, take heed and learn from the lessons of history. There are ominous clouds gathering on your horizon. Yesterday, America was a land of slavery, segregation, lynching, and the Ku Klux Klan. And tomorrow, it will be a land of religious discrimination and concentration camps. You cannot count on the message of solidarity you may get from a civic group or a political party, or the word of support you hear from a kind neighbor or a nice coworker. The West will eventually turn against its Muslim citizens." This is pretty alarmist rhetoric, but I imagine wherever Anwar al-Awlaki is today, He's sort of wagging his finger and saying, I told you so. Look at some of the rhetoric coming out in the presidential
campaign. Well, luckily, you know, his prediction of what, you know, his dystopian view of what would happen in America certainly hasn't happened. Where even though we've got some people saying some stupid things, that, you know, that there's no, there, you know, the Muslim Americans in this country are, you know, they, the American dream has worked pretty well for them. They're as average education the same as the average American, average incomes. You know, where that kind of vision is actually, I think, beginning to take shape is in France. 10% of the Muslim population, 10% of the French population is Muslim. 70% of the French prison population is Muslim, which is kind of an astonishing and I think self-explanatory kind of statistic. And what we, the problem that we already have in Europe is about to be much amplified, because it's not that the million refugees coming in are very, you know, just a tiny, you know, handful may present themselves as who are actually ISIS, who are pretending to be refugees. I mean, the big problem is they're just going to be encountering societies where there is no French dream, there's no British dream, there's no EU dream, there's no mechanism to accept them ideologically as part of the pick your European country. And so that is the time bomb that, you know, maybe, you know, Al-Awlaki, there won't be concentration camps, but clearly there's, I mean, look at the ghettos in which Muslims live in France. And if you look at the Charlie Hebdo attack, you look at the Paris attack, these guys all came from these very grim banlieues, which are like the projects. They all went to prison pretty much. That's where they radicalized. We just don't have that problem here. So that vision is, you know, it's not ever going to be realized, but it has some merit in the European case.
What wound up happening with Anwar al-Awlaki, as you know, is he was killed by an American drone. And one of the questions from the audience says, is the drone a weapon of choice here, and what are the pros and cons of using it? This is something that you've done a lot of research on.
You know, President Obama has killed 3,000 people with drones, if you take the most conservative estimates. Now, the vast majority were militants of some kind, often low-level foot soldiers. That's four times more, roughly, than the number of people sent to Guantanamo by George W. Bush. And so the question, would you prefer to be sent to Guantanamo or killed in a drone strike? I think most people would be prefer to sent to Guantanamo, where you have a reasonable chance of getting out, statistically. So it has become the weapon of this administration. Under President George W. Bush, there was one drone strike in Yemen. There have been 127 drone and cruise missile strikes under President Obama. I mean, and the other thing, of course, his right-wing critics always saying that he's weak. I mean, he's waging wars in seven Muslim countries. They just killed 150 people in Somalia yesterday in airstrikes and drone strikes. We're not at war with Somalia. If you think about it, we've now extended the war to all these countries. We're not in a war with any of them. I mean, that's the interesting thing. You know, we're not at war with the Somali state or the Pakistan state, but we've used this repeatedly. Now, so what's the upside of these? I mean, the upside is they're discriminatory. Drop an F-16 bomb on a house, you're going to kill a lot of people. Drones have become lighter. They can hover for longer. The payloads are lighter. And the civilian casualty rate is going down very dramatically. It was close to 100% when the drone program began in the United States. Now it's, you know, close to 0% because there's so much. But it's of course not 0% all the time. And I would say, you know, that we've created new rules of the road. There are three states that have used armed drones until recently: the United States, United Kingdom, and Israel. Now, Pakistan, Iran, and Nigeria have also used them, and Hezbollah. So the point is, we're getting, you know, our precedents surely will be used by other people, because we make the argument that we use them because states are incapable of taking care of the problem, and that that's the argument. That, in a sense, it's the opposite of the liberal responsibility to protect. It's based on the same theory, which is a state isn't doing what it's supposed to do. So when there's a genocide, we have a responsibility to go in. But the flip side is, the state isn't doing what it's supposed to be doing, taking care of these terrorists, and therefore we have a responsibility to go in and take them out. Now, you can say that theory is either right or wrong, but that is a theory that is being used. And other states will use it. I can guarantee it. The Chinese toyed with the idea of taking out a major drug dealer who was in Myanmar, just over the border from the Chinese border, with an armed drone. And I think they will use it outside their borders at some point to kill Uyghurs in Afghanistan, or pick your target.
So, you know, this raises the notion of these sort of semi or tremendously ungoverned spaces, depending on how you think about it.
Yeah.
You know, raises a real question for us that we haven't cracked. I mean, it gets back to your point about Afghanistan, right? If we keep 6,000 troops in Afghanistan, that sort of puts a cap on the crisis. It doesn't solve that crisis.
No.
It certainly doesn't solve the problem with Pakistan's ungoverned territory. It doesn't solve the problem of ungoverned territory in Syria and Iraq, in North Africa, in Somalia. Are there things that we, you know, why haven't we been able to resolve this problem? And part of the reason we use drones is because we're good at it. It's simple. It's a largely technological solution, as opposed to addressing these larger political problems.
Well, I mean, they're not easy to solve, as you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, but that's not an argument for saying, hey, we're just going to wash our hands of the problem, because that's essentially what we've done on two occasions in Afghanistan. When the Soviets withdrew, we closed our embassy, and we were blind, after that in the 80s. You know, the cost. I mean, the interesting thing about it is the cost of doing things and the cost of not doing things. That's why being president is not an easy job. Because do the thought experiment where, let's say, Obama had really started arming the moderate, if you could find any moderate resistance to Assad, and Assad was overthrown. Well, would Syria be even in worse shape today? I mean, it's a reasonable question. Look at Libya. So there are costs to inaction and there are costs to action. And since we just don't know what the future will hold. But I think that we kind of have an idea in some cases, for instance, in Afghanistan. But I mean, you know, how do we fix this? It's not easy. I mean, and my Afghan friends say we can be Somalia or South Korea, and South Korea was one of the poorest countries in the world after the end of the Korean War. Now it's one of the richest, and that's under an American national security umbrella. And that's the model they want. And they don't necessarily want a lot of American ground troops going around in combat, but they see that whatever problems they have are going to get worse if we're not around.
Mm-hmm. Take a couple of these cards and get at a related question. How long do you think Bashar al-Assad will be in power? Is he going to survive this thing?
I have no idea.
And relatedly, what are the opportunities and challenges of an improved relationship with Iran? We've cut the nuclear deal. Do you think that is going to move on to sort of a broader relationship to stabilize conditions in Iraq and Syria?
I mean, yeah, maybe. We've already seen some, outgrowths of the Iranian nuclear deal that were positive, the release of the Washington Post journalist and other American hostages. And, you know, it's very interesting to me that in the recent Iranian elections, the hardliners all lost their seats, and the people who won their seats were all people who were in favor of the deal with the United States. So, yeah, that's a pretty good indicator of, there's nothing written in stone that whatever regime rules in Iran 20 years from now has to be anti-American. By the way, there's also nothing written in stone that a new Iranian regime that isn't run by the Ayatollahs wouldn't restart its nuclear program. I mean, people tend to like nuclear weapons if they can get them. It's not to do with the ideology of the regime. It's to do with that, states do the math.
Let me bring the conversation back domestically. I mean, you talk about part of the reason why folks radicalize in the West is the geopolitical circumstances. Are they just, anger or frustration around those? There's a lot of talk, as you know, in the U.S. government, and has been for years, about quote-unquote CVE, or countering violent extremism.
Yeah.
How do you prevent people from radicalizing? I mean, part of that question is, why do they radicalize in the first place? And you said that why is one of the hardest things to get at. What are the challenges here for the U.S. government? Can the U.S. government do this?
Yeah, I think the short answer, they can't. They're for two reasons. There's a kiss of death problem, which is they're not seen as a fair actor for by a lot of the people, and secondly, there's the lack of knowledge problem. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think the best the government can do is be aware of the good things that are going on out there, and if they can support it in some way, support it. But you know, people who are really doing really good work do not really want U.S. government support because of the kiss of death problem. You know, the real issue, countering radicalization, I think, is like stopping the tide. And that's a very big issue. What we want to try and do is counter recruitment and stop people joining these groups, and that's a much more targeted. And the people who could do that are former jihadis who can intervene online, clerics who actually know what they're talking about, who can make the Islamic argument that ISIS is not the right path, and defectors. But defectors are difficult because, you know, governments, if you're defecting from ISIS, a lot of governments will just put you in jail. But defectors are the most useful messengers of, hey, this is not the Islamist utopia that everybody thinks it is. And so that's the way you get at it. But you know, how do you operationalize that? What's the role of the U.S. government? I think the U.S. government, what do you think?
I think you're absolutely right. I think it's been very difficult for the U.S. government, and efforts to do this have been very clumsy. I mean, the most famous is the State Department's don't stop, look away.
It's so memorable that we can't remember.
Yeah, we can't remember. But I also think the State Department gets a lot of criticism because that is their one effort in English that is easy for folks to read, and they've done other things in Arabic specifically in Arabic that don't get as much attention, at least in the Western media.
Yeah.
But that raises another question here, right? We've got this surge in propaganda, and the accessibility of it is so much. I mean, it's just so much more accessible now that it's on social media, right? I mean, I can tell you that I've been watching jihadi videos very similar to the ones that ISIS puts out for nearly a decade now. But you had to go to a jihadi website in order to get them. Now those things are available very easily on Twitter, and other social media platforms as well.
And they're in English.
From a journalist's perspective, right, it seems to me that what ISIS is doing is sort of what in a political context would be called earned media, right? You go out there, you have a media event, you get it out there, and you sort of toss out some red meat hoping that it's going to be...
You're talking about ISIS, not Donald Trump.
I'm talking... Right. But honestly, I think the tactics are the same, right? Yeah. You go, I mean, from a media strategies perspective, right? Where you do an event, you create, you know, your own video, you put it up on YouTube, and then you hope that CNN and Fox and MSNBC replay that video and get you free airtime.
Well, I can tell you that, you know, CNN, where I work, I mean, we have adopted a policy where we don't show the videos. If we show anything, it's a one screen grab, you know, so it's a, you know, so we, you know, obviously it would be, you know, and everybody, Fox and other networks, I mean, they're all American citizens. They want to do the right thing. So I think the media has exercised some restraint on this issue, appropriate restraint. But of course, you know, in a way, to some degree, it's irrelevant because, you know, if you have Twitter took down 125,000 pro-ISIS accounts just, 3 weeks ago. Yeah. So, I mean, the people watching this are not watching CNN. So that's a big problem. And then the other, you know, I was at the RSA conference here in San Francisco last week, and I interviewed the Attorney General, John Carlin, who's head of national security, which means he's head of counterterrorism, head of counter-espionage. And I asked him about the 60 cases that have happened last year. Would any of them happened without the online materials? And he said he thought that all of them happened because of this online material, without exception. So we're in a different space, and it's you know, the big question for the government is, you know, it's not a crime in this country to be a radical. The question is, when does a radical become a, you know, militant bent on violence? And until we have a machine that can read people's souls, that's a pretty subtle question often. And that's the dilemma the government faces, because when somebody starts posting on ISIS flags on Facebook, you know, that's, by the way, perfectly legal for the FBI to monitor public postings on Facebook, if you're stupid enough to do that. And then they insert an informant in the case, and you know, that's the case. And the sentences in these cases are very long. Almost all of them are material support sentences, which material support can be in the form of, I volunteer myself to go to join ISIS. That's the material support. I'm not sending money. Well, the sentence in that case is 15 years in a federal prison. That's a long time if you're a teenager. with no history of prior violence.
When you wrestle with this debate in the book, right, yeah. is, you know, what does it mean when the FBI comes across somebody that is, you know, whether they get a tip from somewhere, from a friend or a neighbor or an uncle, or they see something online that's disturbing and you insert an informant. I mean, the accusation, the defense in almost all of these cases, the defense that almost always fails is yeah. entrapment, right? That this yeah. person was talking, they never actually would have done something except that there was an informant that was introduced.
And that is factually true. But as a legal matter, it's not enough because the FBI is always very careful to say at some point, you know, do you really want to go through this? And they'll ask it two or three times on tape. And often, you know, these guys are wannabes, you know, they're friendless. Sometimes they're, you know, I mean, the classic case is well known to Brian is the Newburgh 4 case. It was four essentially homeless men who were promised variously a BMW holiday in Puerto Rico, $250,000. You know, a lot of stuff to go and, like, you know, this half-baked, they had a plan to, you know, blow up synagogues in the Bronx and bring down a plane with a Stinger missile, which, of course, was inert. But, I mean, these guys were just a hapless bunch. And, in fact, the judge at the trial said that the leader was a guy called James Cromedy, and the judge had such a great line about him. She said that James Cromedy was his buffoonery was positively Shakespearean because he was... Which I thought, and that she then sent him to 25 years because of the guidelines. So you know, it's hard because, you know, the homegrown film that that Brian mentioned, which is based very loosely adapted from the book and is a great film by Greg Barker, who's based in L.A., he really gets to this pretty well, which is if you're the FBI guy, you're watching somebody who, let's say, goes to Washington, who's a 19-year-old kid, 18-year-old kid, who goes to Washington, takes some videos of the Pentagon and says, that's where our brother's attacked, is in touch with somebody associated with Al-Qaeda in London. You know, is that guy just, is it bravado or is it something else? And if you're the FBI, are you going to take the risk? The film ends with a great question from the FBI, Phil Mudd, who's also at New America. Essentially, with these kinds of cases, what would you do if you were in my situation? And I think the answer is obviously, if you're the FBI person, you're not going to, like, have the possibility that somebody is radicalizing and may do something violent.
Yeah, and this is such a difficult challenge. And, what people play with is, are there circumstances where there is a third path, right? Where instead yeah. of inserting an informant, you insert an imam that yeah. can have a conversation with a young kid.
And that is a great question because I can give you good examples of where that worked. And I can give good examples. Well, also, by the way, the good examples where that works are not usually that known because, if somebody intervenes and nothing happens, it's not a story. I mean, there's nothing happens. So typically when an intervention is successful, we don't really know about it. But one of the people I portray in the book is a guy called Imam Majid, who runs the third largest mosque in the United States, which is in Northern Virginia. He's Sudanese American. And he's intervened with five men who were flirting with the idea of joining ISIS, and he basically said, got them to change their minds. Now, balanced against that, Shannon Connolly of Denver, Colorado, the FBI talked to her four times. Now, most people, if they get a visit from the FBI, would say, okay, well, you know, I'm just not, whatever I was going to do, I'm not going to do. They suggested instead of joining ISIS that she join a humanitarian organization in Syria or work on behalf of the Syrian people, very sensible thing to suggest to her. But she was absolutely, infatuated by ISIS. She's 19. She was arrested in Denver Airport on the way to join ISIS. So for every, there are often people who try and intervene and it just doesn't work. On the other hand, there are interventions that do work, but you just can't predict which ones will work.
Mm-hmm. We're at a point now where ISIS is clearly on the defensive in Syria and Iraq. Yeah. It still has some momentum in North Africa, in particular in Libya. We had the attack yesterday in Tunisia. Do you think that as this new threat that calls itself the caliphate that has been able to actually establish itself as a government, as that is boxed into a corner, do you think that we're going to see a decline in the amount of effort by Americans to join these kinds of organizations? I mean, are they tied to this kind of geopolitical event?
Yeah, I think the Westerners who are joining are excited by the fact that there is a physical caliphate, by the claims that there is a state that is actually providing social services, and often a lot of the people go there to get married to the men or women of their dreams. You know, so that is all very powerful. If the caliphate was, you know, kind of constricted and suddenly didn't exist, I think that part of that message would be, you know, would be very damaged. But that, it's going to take a while.
Just a broader question. You're one of the, you know, and I think an audience like this that, that doesn't, you know, hasn't seen you in person, but you have this sort of fascinating arc, having studied this, these organizations for such a long time. You know, when you think about Osama bin Laden, a man you met personally, and then you look at some of the leaders of these movements today, I mean, I realize this is tough to draw these comparisons, but can Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi be Osama bin Laden?
Well, he's been more successful on some levels because he's, you know, territory the size of the United Kingdom at, before they started losing territory and several million people under control and, you know, abolishing the Sykes-Picot border between Iraq and Syria. I mean, this is all stuff that bin Laden, you know, would have wanted to do, I think, you know, but saw it as a longer-term project. But I think bin Laden looms larger than Baghdadi, and I'm not quite sure why. But, and I think at the end of the day, if you look at ISIS propaganda, yes, they're in a fight with al-Qaeda, but they think they're the real continuation of bin Laden. And, you know, I use the phrase bin Ladenism to describe this ideology because it is an ideology. Like all ideologies, it claims to explain the past, the present, and the future. And bin Laden was the person who put it out there, which is, you know, history is moving in the direction of this Taliban-style utopia from Indonesia to Morocco. There's some pesky people in the way, the Jews, the Israelis, the Americans, Arab regimes who don't rule like the Taliban. If we get rid of them, utopia will happen. And that, by the way, is the same narrative the Nazis had, and that's the same narrative as the Stalinists had. And it's true. Basically, the most dangerous thing, obviously, is when people say they found the truth, usually there are a lot of dead bodies in the wake of that statement. And this is one of these, you know, ideologies that claims to explain everything. And bin Laden put it in motion. So I think that he, you know, I think he's going to be, you know, when historians of the 22nd century look back, I think he'll be more of a big figure than Baghdadi, but who knows?
Right. Both of these people have inspired attacks, independent attacks in various places. And you've drawn the distinction, and others have drawn the distinction between an attack like the Paris attack, which was centrally organized from Syria, and the San Bernardino strike, which does not seem to have been. At least, you know, maybe if Apple opens up the phone, we'll find something different. But at least, as it seems like these people made this decision on their own. That reflects something you talk about in the book that I think, you know, is very familiar to you and I, but is not something that most people discuss, which is, you know, one of these academic debates that was mentioned in one of the previous questions. But, you know, the debate between Bruce Hoffman and Mark Sageman about how these threats matriculate and how these threats come together. And describe that debate, and then, you know, what are the implications for the way that we organize counterterrorism, depending on how we think about what the threat looks
like? Well, Mark Sageman, this goes back to the Kissinger line about the academic disputes, you know, the stakes are so low. But in this case, the stakes are pretty high, because if Sageman is right that the real threat is from homegrown militants, like we saw in San Bernardino, then why are we in Afghanistan? Why are we in Iraq? Why are we in Syria? And if Bruce Hoffman is right that the big problem is organized terrorist groups that are, you know, kind of have training camps and train people. Now, of course, both are right. The question is which is really the bigger threat. The bigger threat, of course, is people who get trained overseas and are part of a paramilitary organization and have esprit de corps where they get in training camps. And, you know, that is a much bigger threat. You know, the threat, we've created these defenses that make it very hard for a foreign terrorist organization to send a lot of people in to do an attack like that. Now, what's interesting is there's now probably a more of a blended approach. So in Garland, Texas, the two guys who got killed attacking the cartoon contest, not only were they inspired by ISIS, but they were being directed to some degree by somebody inside ISIS to do this. And that's actually kind of a new development, because, you know, there are lots of people in this country. Well, there are enough cases of people in this country, and there's access to weapons is pretty simple. And if ISIS was smart, they would start directing these people to do something more than attacking a Christmas office party. You know, they would direct them to do something more significant. As, you know, the Christmas office party was in San Bernardino. But if those guys, if a couple had, you know, they could have done something much worse, I think. And ISIS would probably presumably want, direct them to do something more symbolic.
There's a couple of questions here that get at this notion that you've heard before, which is, where are in this debate, we hear from counterterrorism professionals, political leaders in the West, and we hear from the jihadis. Where in this debate are the Muslim masses?
Yeah, the problem, there are 1.5 billion Muslims, and you know they don't have a Vatican, and it's sort of hard to, they don't speak with one voice. And you know, a lot of them are at odds with each other and have different, and it, you know, go to Indonesia, it's a profoundly different country than Afghanistan, which is a profoundly different country from Morocco. And I mean, you know, these are, so, you know, the idea that they would speak with one voice, I think is sort of, it's not going to happen because it's not organized in such a way that that's even feasible. But I will say that there is a lot more condemnation of terrorism by Muslim leaders than Americans seem to have processed. I mean, one of the people I profile in the book, Imam Majid from Northern Virginia, signed on with 200 other clerics, an open letter to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leader of ISIS, and they took him on in Arabic and English and other languages on very Islamic terms. It was not a liberal critique of ISIS, of which would be very easy to do. It's a highly informed, you know, they are very observant Muslims who are taking, they're leading clerics. And, you know, that story, it's out there, but it doesn't get a lot of play in the United States for some reason, because it doesn't fit the narrative that Muslims aren't saying anything. But the fact is they are.
They are. Do you think that it matters in terms of the recruitment? Well, because I agree.
That's a great question. Bear in mind, I mean, I'm not a mathematician, but like, let's do the math here. The 1.5 billion Muslims there, let's say 30,000 people in ISIS. I mean, that's a infinitesimally small percentage. So, you know, how to influence them? That's hard. It's not like this is some mass movement. Do these statements by Muslim clerics make a difference? Maybe not, but they're certainly not. They're worth something, I think. Every time there's a terrorist attack, the Muslim organizations in this country issue a condemnation. One actually interesting wrinkle to that, one of the people I profiled in the book is Nader Hassan, who's a successful lawyer in Northern Virginia who's got a beer in the fridge. He's Nidal Hassan's double first cousin, so they were genetically like brothers because two brothers and sisters had married each other and then they had their kids. Now, this goes back to the why question. So Nidal Hassan becomes a mass murderer. Nader Hassan, with pretty much the same set of cards, is a successful lawyer in Northern Virginia who has beers in the fridge, plays golf, helped out George W. Bush during 9/11, volunteered. So, you know, it shows that the why is kind of very difficult. But one thing that Nader says is he's a secular Muslim, but his voice is not really being heard. Mm-hmm. You know, yes, he may observe Ramadan, but he's got a beer in the fridge and he doesn't see himself as a sort of fundamentalist Muslim. And that's, I thought, an interesting perspective, because most of these organizations that speak for Muslims in this country are fundamentally Islamic in character.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, we are at the point in the program where there is time for one question. And the last question I'm going to ask you is, hopefully you're going to say something totally brilliant here. What's the, if you had one thing to tell the next president on, you know, whenever they're sworn in January, not Afghanistan, because we've already covered that, something else, what would you ask them to do to affect this challenge based on what you've learned about radicalization in the United States?
Well, I think, you know, this is not going to happen, but, you know, President Obama in his second term has gestured towards this. It's on several speeches, he's tried to level with the American people. He's like, you know, basically the threat is homegrown militants who have a natural ceiling to what they can do. And, you know, attacks by foreign terrorist organizations against American targets overseas. We just saw a Starbucks was attacked in Jakarta, Indonesia. Mm-hmm. And that's the threat. I mean, so if I would, you know, terrorism doesn't work if you're not terrorized. And, you know, presumably if you have the facts, you can kind of have a more rational response to all this. So I don't think this would happen in a first term presidency, but because, you know, President Obama has tried it as a second term president. I don't think the message has really been heard, unfortunately. But, you know, I mean, everybody in this room presumably is a strong believer in evidence. And I think the evidence shows that this is a problem we have contained and managed. And by the law of averages, they will get one through occasionally. But it won't be a very big deal. It will be a tragedy, but it won't be a national catastrophe like 9/11 or the Paris attacks.
Our thanks to Peter Bergen, CNN's national security analyst. and author of the new book, United States of Jihad, Investigating America's Homegrown Terrorists. We also thank our audience is here and on radio, television, on the internet. We want to remind everyone here that Mr. Bergen's new book is for sale, and he'll be signing copies in the fireside room following the program. I'm Brian Fishman, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.